Hey guys, it's H-Town Wheelhouse, and tonight we are joined by Bill Brown, former Houston Astros color commentator. He was in the booth with the likes of Larry Durker, Jim DeShays, and Alan Ashby. We're going to talk to him about his most memorable calls, maybe how the game has changed now compared to where it was when he was in the booth, and what life is like after retirement. So anyways, stay tuned. We're going to talk to Bill Brown, otherwise known as Brownie, next.
Get your cameras ready. Line drive right center field. That's number 3,000. And he drives in a run, and he's going for second. Tavares with the throw. He's out, but that's 3,000 hits for Craig Biggio. It ties the ball game. He arrived 20 years ago from Smithtown, New York, with Texas-sized dreams. And now, as he's mobbed by his teammates, those dreams have become reality. And they'll be recognized someday in another town in New York, Cooperstown. 3,000 hits for Craig Biggio, the 27th man to reach that figure.
Here comes Patty and Quinn, the boys in uniform tonight down in the dugout. Connor and Kevin have been on the last couple of road trips.
We were told Craig did not want the game stopped very long tonight, but obviously the moment has to be celebrated.
Oh, absolutely.
What a time for Houston baseball. One of the few players to get all of his 3,000 hits for one team.
Loving it with the boys and Patty and Quinn. Just nine now. Craig Biggio becomes the ninth player in Major League Baseball history with 3,000 hits or more, all with one team. And he is overwhelmed. He was bound and determined to get to second base. He wanted that double in the worst way.
Dave Wallace, Lance Berkman, as the teammates come one by one now to get their moment with Bitch.
Hey guys, thanks for tuning in to H-Town Wheelhouse. This is H-Town Wheelhouse and Astros podcast, and tonight I have the honor of being joined by the community outreach executive for the Houston Astros, Bill Brown, former color commentator for the Houston Astros. Mr. Brown, thank you for joining us this evening.
Thank you, Brett. Please make it Bill, Brownie, whatever you prefer.
Definitely, yes. I do remember the days of you being called Brownie. I believe Alan Ashby gave you that nickname.
Well, you know, I go back to Cincinnati days and I guess I'm complimenting myself, but the first player I can remember calling me Brownie was Tom Seaver. So that does take me back a few decades. But, you know, it's just, and I think Phil Garner might have been the first with the Astros. It's in baseball, it just seems that everybody has to have a nickname, and it's usually some derivative of the last name.
Yes, sir, definitely. No, yeah, that's, you know, and they say if people give you nicknames, they typically means they like you if there's, you know, if there's nothing – you know, derogatory in there. So that's definitely good. And, you know, I was looking back at your history and broadcast. Of course, growing up in Houston, I was glued to the TV watching the Houston Astros with the HSC network, with the various networks that they've been through. And I do remember you as one of the main broadcasters that I, you know, kind of grew up watching. But I know before you got to Houston, you were in Cincinnati. You did, you know, baseball play by play, but you did some other sports. What were some of the other sports you kind of delved into right before you got like full time into Major League Baseball?
Well, that's funny because I wound up doing some hockey, some indoor soccer, some tennis, some bowling. So, you know, sports that are not normally televised all that often at that level. And it was a great learning experience. But being on staff there at the TV station, whatever they wanted to do, and it came my way, I was willing to take a stab at it, no matter how amateurish I sounded at the time.
No, that's awesome. I mean, you basically started at, I mean, right at 18 years of age, correct?
Well, I did. I was in high school, and I got a job for my small town radio station, and so that's how I got my start. But it's, you know, when I was 14, for some reason, Brett, this is what I wanted to do. So that was just a big deal for me then.
You know, I talked to Gerald Sanchez. He's a local guy. I'm not sure if you are familiar with him. He does some stuff with U of H.
Yes.
And Gerald told me kind of the same thing. When he was a kid, he would actually act like he was commentating the baseball games, even, you know, as young as 14, probably even 11 or 12. And it that seems to be the common theme as to where, you know, you interview baseball players and they're like, you know, when I was five, I dreamed of this. And but, you know, also commentators, that seems to be something where it's something you realize you have or you want early on.
I agree. And for me, it was eliminating being a player because I wasn't that good and realizing that, boy, I love this game. This game is just so attractive to me. How close can I get to it? And that seemed to be the closest way for me to attach myself to baseball. So I was constantly listening to games. I would do those things you talked about. We had one game a week when I was a kid, Saturday afternoon. I'd turn down the sound on the TV, get the rosters, and just try to do the game myself on my little tape recorder. I'd go out to my high school baseball games or any kind of game, really, and try my hand at it. And I remember reading Al Michaels' book, You Can't Make This Up, a couple of years ago, and he talked about being in his house and describing his mother in the kitchen. So that's a whole different art form there.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah, that definitely takes color commentating to a whole new level.
Yeah, I thought so. That's a challenge. But no, the key, I think, for all of us who are trying to do this at that young an age is to get the powers of description developed as soon as possible.
Mm. Yeah. No, yeah, I'm really mesmerized when I listen to various sports or even like, I think play by play guys, are different than maybe a color commentator. And, I know you've had a hand in both, but it seems like those other sports, like you said, hockey or even like basketball. Did you do some announcing for the Xavier basketball team?
I did. And, University of Cincinnati. And okay. Then this was before your time, but when the ABA came along, the American Basketball Association, we had a team that was a regional team. That the name of the team was the Kentucky Colonels, and they were based in Lexington, or Louisville, rather. But they played games in Lexington. They played games in Cincinnati. They played games as a regional sort of team. So I think they played maybe 15 games in Cincinnati. But we televised on the Cincinnati station, maybe 8 or 10 of their games. And I did some of those games. And so that was an interesting time in sports of expansion. And it meant more jobs. And it meant that guys like me got a chance to branch out a little bit.
No, yeah, that's awesome. And I see that in, I guess you were with the Reds from 76 to 82. And in 76, they were coming off their 75 championship, is that correct?
Yes.
And so what was that like, being in Cincinnati, you know, the year after the World Series? Now, correct me if I've got my history wrong, because I don't have my 75 roster pulled up. Was that the ball club with, like, was that Rose? Was that Morgan? Was that those guys on that 75 big?
Yeah. Yes, it was. Yes, okay. It was. Big Red Machine, Tony Perez, Johnny Bench. Great, great team, Ken Griffey and George Foster. And so we moved there in 72 to Cincinnati. And that very first year working there, they made it to the World Series and they lost Game 7 to Oakland by one run. And that was actually the second time they had made the series in the 70s. They made it in 1970 and lost to Baltimore. So that was a team that was really one of the greats of all time, because then they went back in 75 and won it, in 76 again they won it. So they were in four World Series there in the first 6 years of the decade, and that they were really one of the all-time greats.
Yeah, that's got to be exciting. I know when I look back and I watch those teams, that decade for the Cincinnati Reds just seemed to be really, really fun. Getting to watch. I remember watching Pete Rose when he was a little bit older as a player, like in the Astrodome. But just to see him in his heyday, like in his rookie season, just remember watching how aggressive he was on TV. Now was Vida Blue a part of those teams?
Actually, that's an interesting story. He was with Oakland, and Charlie Finley, the owner of the Oakland A's, wanted to rebuild. So he was willing to trade Vida Blue to the Cincinnati Reds. They made a trade one winter. The Reds put Vida Blue in their media guide because the trade was pretty close to spring training, and they had a deadline to publish the media guide. And then the commissioner, Bowie Kuhn, nullified the trade because the Reds were going to be sending quite a bit of cash to Oakland, and Bowie Kuhn did not think that was good for baseball. So then Vida Blue was no longer a Red and had never put on a uniform, but had been traded to Cincinnati.
Okay. Yeah, I had always wondered about that. I didn't know if he actually played for him, or that's interesting. I guess I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
So having all that, just amazing experience with all the different play-by-play, I'm sure getting to know people. I'm sure even though you're based in Cincinnati, you're getting to know people from other cities. I'm assuming, did you travel? Did you just do, was it just home games, or did you do home and away? How did that work when you were with the Reds, Reds organization?
That was a totally different time, Brett. In those days, the Reds did not believe that it was to their best interest to televise home games. They thought it hurt their attendance. So we actually only were allowed to do about three home games per year back in the 70s. Which meant, and we were only televising maybe 40, 50 games, something like that. So oh, wow. Almost all of our telecasts were on the road, which meant I was traveling quite a bit.
Oh, wow. Okay. So you were kind of a traveling salesman. You were, say bye to the family and you go on the road with the team. That's interesting. I didn't realize that. I guess, we get hyper-focused on when we grow up and how things are, because all I've ever known is growing up and, starting in 87, when you started with the Astros, it was like, there's Bill Brown, there's Jim Deshaies, there's Bill Royale. I mean, y'all were just there every day. And so I guess in my small world view, I just assume, they've always been announcing all the games, but that makes sense. I mean, I guess back then there was probably less money flying around like there is today.
Right. And, it was a gradual process. I think what really turned the table there, Brett, as far as getting more games televised, was when regional sports cable outfits like HSE came along. They needed the programming. They had nothing. All they were doing was sports. Unlike the station I worked for in Cincinnati, it was an NBC affiliate. So they had all the NBC programs, and if they did a Reds game on a Wednesday night, that meant that you weren't watching some of the NBC favorite programs that people wanted to watch. Of course, in Cincinnati, baseball was big, so they prefer to watch the Reds, but still, there'd be a few people that weren't baseball fans, and they weren't getting to see their NBC shows because they were preempted by the Reds, and they were not all that happy. But then in the 80s, that's when the regional sports networks came in. And that included HSE, and then HSE expanded to Pittsburgh. And I was actually in Pittsburgh for the HSE startup there. And so they did Pirates games, but they were, they wanted sports on live every night because people were paying extra to get their channels at that time. And they had to have a product that was worthy of charging for it, something like 12, 15 bucks a month, whatever it was. So HSE, yes, they wanted the Astros on live every night, and they had to be willing to pay dearly for it so the ball club would see that it was worth their while to have all these home games on TV.
Wow. So you did work with HSE before you started in Houston in 87?
Right, I did. 1 year in Pittsburgh. And so okay. and then I also worked for another regional sports cable channel in Cincinnati called Sports Time Cable Network. And Sports Time was owned by Anheuser-Busch. It went out of business after 1 year, just as HSE in Pittsburgh did. So I was kind of a bad luck charm to be with two of those babies that went up in flames. But, you know, nobody wanted to be near me after a couple of those. But, the interesting concept of the Sports Time Cable Network was that they thought this would work, and it didn't. On a regional basis, they would have games on in Cincinnati and St. Louis and Des Moines and all these places in the Midwest. So they carry, you know, 20 Cincinnati games, 20 Chicago White Sox games, and 20 Kansas City Royals games. And so they'd have a game on just about every night, but it was different teams. And that just never took hold. It just didn't work.
Well, you know, I remember before getting my daily dose of Astros through HSE, it was TBS, Turner Broadcasting, or WGN, you know, Chicago Cubs. And I remember having to watch other ball clubs. And, you know, like WGN was like a regular channel. But I'm thinking the Cubs fans probably had a little easier time missing their shows. They always seem to be a little more dedicated than others.
Yeah, and I guess they had some good syndicated programs that they ran on WGN. I can't remember. But, yeah, it wasn't – back in that day, that was kind of the heyday of network TV. You know, you had Hill Street Blues and these very popular shows on every Friday night or whatever, and people would just get married to these shows. They didn't want to ever miss one. But WGN had, you know, reruns that were 5, 6, 7 years old. So, yeah, they weren't nearly as popular as the network shows at that point.
Definitely. So, needless to say, since starting in the 70s until now, I know your last like call, and I know you do some guest appearances on AT&T Sportsnet. I know you were, I guess, last in the booth officially 2016 is when you did some things. But how have you seen the game like change? I mean, we all know the obvious things with the long ball and stuff, but what are like one or two things that really stand out to you, like watching the Big Red Machine in 76 and watching, you know, the Astros in this last 2 or 3 years where they've just had this phenomenal ball club? What are the one or two major differences that really stick out in your mind?
Well, Brett, I think there are many, but just to limit it to a few, back in the 70s, that was the era of the artificial turf multipurpose stadiums. So you had Riverfront Stadium in Cincinnati, and you had the Astrodome, and you had Three Rivers Stadium in Pittsburgh, and Philadelphia, you had Veterans Stadium there. So, and there were others as well. But they played football and baseball in these stadiums and other sports as well. So these stadiums were developed so that a football field could securely fit into that amount of space to go along with the baseball diamond and other sports like soccer. And because of that, they put the artificial turf down. So, you know, they didn't have to do all the maintenance of the grass and all the remarking of the lines on grass. They could do it on turf. And it just did not show that it was as effective as the current baseball-only stadiums like Minute Maid Park, because these stadiums these days are built for one sport in mind. So the spectators are much closer to the field. Everything's designed. The seats are turned toward the mound, so you don't have to turn your body, because if you went into the Astrodome or Riverfront Stadium and you were sitting down the right field line, your seat was pointed probably toward the center fielder. So you had to angle your body a little bit back toward the mound and to see, you know, it just wasn't as comfortable as the stadiums are today because they couldn't be designed just for one sport.
Right.
But the game itself, too, was different in the sense that, yeah, the Big Red Machine scored a lot of runs. But back in the 70s, there was more likely to be a 3-2 game, a 4-2 game. There was more likely to be a sacrifice bunt that might get the eventual winning run into scoring position. A key stolen base, more triples, more doubles, higher batting averages, and fewer home runs. So, and the stadiums were larger. The balls didn't travel as well as they have been recently, which has been a problem for Major League Baseball. So, you know, all in all, a lot of close games, some well-pitched games, and I think really entertaining baseball. And now you have, you know, the infield shifts and more and more hitters trying to hit fly balls, et cetera. So fewer ground balls, lower batting averages because of the shifts. And it's a totally different game. It really is quite different now.
No, yeah, you know, I think I can't remember the number exactly. It's either 51 or 53%. It may be higher of all runs in the major leagues now are scored via the home run. And that has, you know, the whole trajectory, exit velocity, barreled balls, all these, you know, all these saber metrics that they brought into the game. So do you think that that's really what has contributed to the, I call it the era of the situational pitcher, where back in the day, starting pitchers were going longer because they weren't giving up long balls. They weren't giving up a ton of runs, as to where in the ballparks we have now, some of my friends call Minute Maid Park the juice box, you know, or, you know, we make these almost, you know, Pine Derby stadiums, and where the ball flies out further and the pitchers seem to exit sooner because, why, they're giving up runs and, well, we got to get someone else in. Do you think that, like, with the stadium size, you think that has caused an evolution in the way they use pitchers because of the long ball?
I think that's part of it. I think the stadium size, I think the hitters are more powerful. I think the baseballs are livelier now than they were then. And, you know, the hitting philosophy is just quite different. Back in the 70s and 80s, batting average was more important than it is now. Striking out was more of a black eye than it is now. Bunting was more important than it is now. Almost everybody knew how to bunt back at that time. And so the game really has lost some of the small ball skills, I think, that the hitters used to work on and really develop. They're not working on those anymore.
Right, right. No, yeah, you know, just to kind of translate it with, you know, connect it with another sport, but just how modern sports has changed. A friend of mine's a high school basketball coach here in Texas, and he always tells his players, don't watch the NBA.
Interesting.
Because he said so much of what they do in the NBA is not what I want you doing on the court, because it's not good fundamental basketball. He's like, if you want good fundamental basketball, watch NCAA women's Division I basketball. They've got great fundamentals. And so it's just interesting, though, because, you know, that has changed. Rarely do I tell my 12-year-olds in Little League, hey, you know, I'll say go watch Altuve, or I'll say go watch Bregman, but you really can't, because the things they're doing are really professional level type of things. And so, you know, the game has changed, and that's what I've liked over the years. I feel like the Astros have done a phenomenal job changing with the game, and maybe being on the front end of actually being some of the people that actually are the game changers, if I'm saying that correctly.
I think you are. And, you know, when I look at today's game and I look at a player like Joey Gallo with the Texas Rangers, who has enormous power, and it wouldn't surprise me if he would hit 60 home runs if the ball stays this lively. But on the other hand, the way the infield shifts are deployed against Joey Gallo, if he would just bunt, if he would put down a bunt somewhere close to third base, and, you know, I've heard him say, well, I don't want to do that because I have a better chance of helping my team with an extra base hit than with a bunt. Well, true, I agree with that. However, if you think about it, a Joey Gallo bunt should be a double, because if he put it down anywhere near third base, there is not a fielder who can get over there. The pitcher would be the most likely to get to that ball and try to throw him out before he got to second base. So if you put it that way to Joey Gallo, why wouldn't he occasionally try to drop one down? If it's a pitcher who's tough for him to hit, why not give it a shot?
Right, right. You know, this last summer, I actually had the opportunity to interview some guys at Round Rock, and Josh Rojas, one of the guys that we traded for Zach Greinke, I got to interview him, and he said one of the things he noticed that when he got to Corpus, he was struggling, and he said he was trying to hit the long ball, and what he didn't realize when he got to Corpus was Corpus is not the place to try to hit the long ball because of the humidity and everything down there, all the elements. And so he started watching. I think that was a time when Reddick had kind of turned his swing around and started hitting a lot of opposite field, you know, balls. And he said, I watched that and I talked to Reddick, and he said, I got to talk to him. And he said, I got away from who I was as a hitter trying to hit this long ball. And so I was trying to place the ball in the places where the players weren't. And my average went up, you know, 30, 40 points. And so, I mean, there's a lot more strategy involved, it seems, too, as a hitter. It's like the hitters aren't just taking their cuts in the cages and then, hey, let's go to the game and, you know, let's outscore them or let's out hit them. It's like, well, crap, I've got to hit a ball in a place where there's six fielders, you know?
Exactly. And that's a great point you're making. And I saw Josh Rojas and I really liked him as a player. But I think he has realized exactly what he should be doing, because Josh Rojas is a base stealer. And if he would get more singles, he could steal second base and turn that into a double in effect. So he would be helping his team just as much as if he's swinging away for an extra base hit.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I mean, the game has definitely evolved, and you know, I've seen it go through a lot of changes. You know, growing up, I guess when I was in junior high and high school, my idol growing up was Mark McGwire, and, you know, watching the steroid era. And, you know, I was talking to someone the other day. I remember when Bob Allen interviewed him after a game. I had just graduated college in 98, and my dad had got me two tickets to every Cardinals Astros game in the Astrodome. And so I was so excited. I actually got his autograph for the first time that series, but I got to see him hit the 11th upper deck home run in Astrodome history. And I remember going home that night and watching the news and seeing Bob Allen interview him. And he was talking about how he just kind of felt like this caged lion and all this stuff. But I remember behind him, there was this whole, like, there was like an Andrusine bottle behind him. And I've seen baseball go through all these different eras and changes and adjust. And I'm just wondering, like, What does Major League Baseball, what do you think, you know, because it seemed like they really valued the home run. Do you think that, I mean, with the whole baseball controversy, do you think that they want more home runs? Do they want that home run chase? Are they seeing too many batters go down? I mean, are they trying to kind of manipulate the game? Or, I don't know. I mean, what is it? I mean, because there's a million conspiracy theories out there, right?
Right. My feeling from what I've read from the commissioner, Rob Manfred, is that they do not feel that home runs are leading to better attendance, because attendance has actually dropped the last couple of years. I think they realize now that what they have is too much of an all or nothing sport, home run or strikeout.
Okay.
And of course, you can figure walks in there, too. But I think for me, and not necessarily for other people, but just for me, being an older fan, the game is less interesting than in the 70s when, yes, there were home runs, but there were more doubles. There were more triples. There were sacrifice bunts. There were stolen bases. There were great fielding plays. The ball is not in play as much now. And, you know, I've sat there with a stopwatch and I've timed, you know, the amount of minutes that the ball is actually in play. And this would be starting from, we'll be generous and say from when the pitcher starts his windup,
okay,
until if the batter doesn't swing or swings and misses, it hits the catcher's mitt. Or if the ball is in play, to whenever play is stopped, whenever it's thrown back to the infield after a double or what have you. Or even with what I was timing was even a home run, I would include the entire home run trot, because we'll just say that's part of the entertainment value for the fans of the ball being in play, even though it's not and play for the entire home run trot. And right, it would be a ridiculously small amount of time, you know, something like 12 or 13 minutes in a three and a half hour game.
That's insane.
Yeah, but I feel, and if the commissioner is serious about what he has said, and I think he is, that that's where the direction of the game should be steered toward in the future. And, you know, you're going to have home runs. You're going to have strikeouts because now the Major League general managers have really oriented their rosters toward, well, we've got to have home run hitters now. The other teams are hitting them. We have to be able to get back in a game when we're trailing with a three-run homer. So the whole, you know, it's been a copycat industry ever since it began, and it's still very much that way now.
Well, yeah, you know, it's kind of like whenever the Yankees signed Edwin Encarnacion. I mean, they signed him for one reason. They signed him to hit home runs. And you saw in the postseason, he couldn't hit the broadside of a barn. But, I mean, it doesn't mean that he's not a good hitter. It doesn't mean that he can't make contact. They just, for whatever reason, had his number. And he just, I mean, he could not hit the ball, you know. But that's why they got him. They got him for one reason and one reason only, to hit the ball out of the park. And I think a lot of those signings are high risk, high reward.
Yes.
And so, yeah, and it does take away from the game. You know, I remember growing up, my dad would take me to he would take me to Arlington to go see the Oakland A's play, because I was a big Mark McGwire fan. And I remember getting to see Ricky Henderson steal bases and, you know, getting to see these guys just I remember Ricky Henderson breaking all those stolen base records. And man, when I met him, he's probably one of the most cocky people I've ever met. But he wasn't cocky like he was rude. He just, like, you just knew when you walked in the room with him that that's Ricky Henderson and you're not him. But it was amazing, though, watching those guys steal all those bases. And, you know, I do miss that. I mean, because we've got guys who have speed. It's just not in our game plan. You know, I mean, you've got an Altuve. You've got Mariznick. You've got Springer. I mean, you got Tucker coming up. I mean, Tucker's got one of the – I think his top 75% in his sprint speed in the league. I've looked up some metrics on those guys. But it's like you said, it's just the game has changed. And they're like, oh, this guy stole 30 bases on the season. I'm like, that's not good. Like, 70 to 100 stolen bases is good to me. That's what I grew up on.
Right. And, you know, Joe Morgan in Cincinnati would steal 55, 60. He could have stolen 80 if he wanted to. But he really didn't want to run when the game was out of control. He wanted to save his legs for a meaningful stolen base. But right. There was such, you know, you remember that time with Ricky Henderson and those base stealers. There was such anticipation when they got on first base. Okay, when's he going to go? Is it the first pitch, third pitch? And that's a big part of the entertainment value for a fan.
Yeah, I remember him and Vince Coleman, you know, Delano DeShields came in behind them. I think Marquise Grissom also was a big base stealer with the Montreal Expos. You know, just guys like that was just fun. I was wanting to ask you to kind of turn our attention towards the Astros. I know you had the opportunity to call several kind of milestone type of things for various Astros players. But for you, if you were to look back, just speaking of your time with the Houston Astros, which one of the calls do you think means the most to you, or do you remember the most, or is it something where you're just like thankful that you were just there for more than one great moment?
Well, I think your last statement would be the one I would choose, because you know, I just had the great pleasure of being there for Craig Biggio's entire career, Jeff Bagwell's entire career, and it was just glorious to be there on an everyday basis. And there were big moments like hit number 3,000 for Craig and Jeff's 400th homer and things like that. And those will be things that I'll cherish for a long, long time. But, you know, it's interesting to talk to a broadcaster, Brett, about these things, because it might not be what you would think. And I was writing an article recently about Matt Cain's perfect game. Matt Cain pitched a perfect game against Houston in 2012, and we televised that game. It was in San Francisco, and the Astros were not a good team that year. But but you know, nonetheless, and it was a one-sided. It was like a 10-0 Giants win, so very, very one-sided game. So the only drama was whether he would get this perfect game or not, right. And he did. And it was just such an interesting game to broadcast, being with the other team. Yep. Now you know that nobody's going to play your highlight calls. And that's fine, but you still have this responsibility, you know, to your viewers to hype this thing. Even though it's somebody with the other team, this is a big deal. There have only been about 33 of these in Major League history. So this is and it's the only one I ever did. It just struck me in the late innings of that game. Hey, now you got to bear down. This is a big deal here. And it was kind of fun to do a game like that where our team was not the one doing these fantastic things on the field.
Right. No, yeah. And that's something I've noticed about baseball, I think, compared to other sports, is that there is a healthy respect for an opposing team. I notice, you know, when Justin Verlander most recently threw his no-hitter in Toronto, or if the Astros do something where they're in Oakland or somewhere, it just seems like baseball's like fan base has a respect because you have a lot of people that are veteran baseball fans. You know, there's a name floating around, I guess, Astros fan communities, where some people are called the 17ers, where they like, they just became fans in 2017. And so if someone calls you a 17er, that's like a big insult. And like, people get really pissed off about it when they hear that. They're like, you don't, and what's funny is they like state their case. Like, I actually have to admit, I think I got called a 17er once and I was like, no, wrong. I was like, my first game, I was 3 years old. And I remember, cause I have pictures to prove it, in the Astrodome. So, but there seems to be a respect for if someone else is throwing a no-hitter, or someone else has a perfect game, or if someone from the other team's going for the cycle, that, you know, if it's someone like a Mike Trout, just the amazing player he is, and he's going for the cycle, I mean, you don't want the Angels to beat the Astros, but gosh, if you could watch him hit for the cycle, or you can watch them belt three or four home runs in one game. I mean, that's still exciting to see, I think.
No doubt. And I think the best type of a season in baseball is one with a lot of surprises, one with a lot of good teams, one with, you know, great players like Mike Trout. He's appreciated everywhere he goes. He is a tremendous ambassador for the game. There's never been anything negative that I can think of associated with Mike Trout. And I've been down there, you know, taking pictures by the Angels dugout, just for a hobby type thing. I do some amateur photography, and it's just amazing the way he interacts with the Houston fans. He's coming back in from the outfield, and he's tossing a ball to a kid, and he is just a wonderful ambassador for the game. So I could never root against a guy like a Mike Trout. Yeah, I'd love those moments when he is accomplishing things that have made him an MVP.
Yeah, that's awesome. You know, it's actually really cool to actually talk to you, because I told my wife, I was like trying to explain to my wife why I was so kind of amped up about interviewing you. And I was like, you don't understand. I was like, growing up, he was what Todd Callis and Jeff Blum are to Sammy. Like, and she's like, oh, okay. She's not real big into sports, but she knows who the TV personalities are, you know? And so, you know, and to know that you've been there through many different eras. Do you look back now? And of course, I mean, you're retired. I'm sure you're enjoying your retirement. Are there times when you miss going in the booth, or was it something where you did it for so many years, you know, so many games in a year, that you don't really, I mean, you miss the grind, but you don't miss, you know what I'm saying?
I honestly will say I do not miss doing the games. I do 10 games on radio. This year I did 10 games on radio. Mm-hmm. With Steve Sparks, I had some vacation time. So I got a little taste of it, and it was fun. And, you know, it's actually a little bit more work when you haven't done a game for a month or 6 weeks and you're trying to prepare, because you haven't paid the kind of attention that you do when you're doing games. And so it requires a little bit more review and paying attention. But it was a good challenge, and I enjoyed working with Robert Ford. But no, I honestly, you know, I got to that point in 2016 of just saying, you know, I've been so blessed with this career. I don't want to be fumbling around for names. I don't want this to be, oh boy, he's really in decline here. The last couple of years, it's been brutal. I just couldn't have handled that. I really thought that was starting to happen at that point. I said, okay, it's time. And I was completely at peace with it, and I've been great with it ever since.
Right. Well, you know, and I mean, there's been the greats, the legends, you know, just all the guys from LA, Chicago, you know, and I mean, but I mean, you know, SNL made a living for about 10 years off of, you know, Harry Carey and, you know, his, you know, kind of miscues or mishaps, but in that kind of, I think that was also done kind of out of respect because of what a well-known person he was, you know, he seemed to really, you know, the thing I liked about him is right in the middle of a play, he would start talking about some local business and like promoting someone's business, some like mattress store or something. And then he would go right back into the play. But I wanted to ask you, you know, I've noticed you received several awards, several accomplishments. I see that you've been a part of the Cyfair Education Foundation, things like that. What are some of the things that you get to be involved in the community that you feel like maybe broadcasting kind of helped you be more of an influence? And, you know, like, what are your favorite things to do out there in the community?
Well, thank you for asking that question. I think it was 11 years ago. I was asked to be part of the Cyfair Educational Foundation Salute to Our Heroes event, which is a scholarship dinner. We raise some money for scholarships for high school seniors.
Right.
So as a matter of fact, this afternoon, I was at Bridgeland High School in Cyprus doing a video to promote our next dinner, which is coming up in February. And it'll raise, you know, around probably 100,000 or thereabouts for scholarships for students. You know, you realize we have 12 high schools in the Cyfair Independent School District. 12. It's the third largest district in Texas. So we have scholarships going to every high school, all 12 of them. We give at least two scholarships to every single high school. And I was asked to join this board of trustees for the foundation. I think it was 3 years ago. Yeah, this is my third year on that. So I'm involved beyond that. But I initially was involved just in the one Salute to Our Heroes event, emceeing that and being a co-chair of that the last few years. My wife is co-chair of the Synod Auction. So we're working on it now and the events in February. And that's become a big deal for us, because as I've joined the board of trustees, I realized that we have other events. We have Salute to the Stars for the teachers. We have the superintendent's fun run, and they all raise money for scholarships. So last year, this foundation awarded more than $600,000 total in scholarships. And something like that, you know, as great as it has been to do baseball games, this is very, very important work. And it's just kind of shifting the focus, Brad. We feel, my wife and I, very strongly, people have been so great to us here. We've lived here about 33 years now, and we owe it to the community to do things like this. And it's actually very satisfying work. It's fun to roll up your sleeves, and there are a lot of other people doing this too. So it's just easy to get in line and try to help a little bit.
No, yeah, that's awesome. I actually teach, I teach seventh grade Texas history, and I've actually been in the classroom for 10 years. I was youth pastor for 17 years before that. And I've just slowly kind of gotten into these where, like, I'm doing this podcast, the Stroh's 411 page, which, you know, that which you so graciously gave us a awesome review for. And just things that I'm trying to do to make really a positive impact. But really what I see, because we have a great education foundation in our school district in Pearland ISD, Ed Thompson, who's a state representative, I'm friends of his family. They just do phenomenal work. You know, they give out grants to teachers, innovative grants. They do scholarships. And so when I saw that, I was like, oh, man, that's really cool. Because I know how much our education foundation does. And especially for you with being in retirement, you have that time to give. You're able to like invest yourself in that. And that's definitely has to be very, very rewarding. Now, as a fan, do you attend the games regularly, or does it kind of like as it fits in your schedule? You know,
I do attend, Brad, regularly. But if it's a 10-game homestand, I might go to 5 games. And, you know, as I get ready, if I'm going to be broadcasting a series, we'll say the third week in May, then about 2 weeks ahead of that point, I'll start paying a lot more attention to games.
Right.
I usually watch every road game that I can, but it's at the point now, hey, if my wife wants to go out to dinner, let's do that. If we get a chance to socialize with another couple or do something at church, let's do that. So I'm not married to it the way I used to be, but yes, I sort of selectively pay attention, and I go as a fan now. Usually when I go down there, we may take another couple down with us and sit in the seats and just enjoy the game. And I couldn't tell you what anybody's batting average is or any of that, but we're just having a good time.
Yeah. I'm sure you get questions as if you're in the broadcasting booth to where, when you were really, you know, full bore into it, you could probably call off all kinds of stuff, because as a broadcaster, you have to have that knowledge right there, you know, at the forefront. So are you still the community outreach executive?
Yes. And
okay.
So if somebody, you know, wants me to speak at a luncheon or a dinner or MC something, that's part of my job of doing things for the Astros Foundation. We had an Adopt a Fire Station program. So Jose Altuve volunteered to go on 9/11 to fire station number 27. And he autographed his jersey number 27, and it was framed, and it's up on the wall at that fire station right now. They gave him a tour. He signed every autograph. He took every photo.
Wow.
Very, very gracious. And so it was a different player every month going to the corresponding fire station of his uniform number. And that's a good program. But things like that, yes, I'm down for those things.
Yeah, that's neat. My son has been he was an Astros buddy when he was younger, and he got to take the field a couple times with the Astros buddies. And the first time he did, he got to go out with Jose Altuve. And what was funny about that was about 2 weeks before that, we had met him on the sideline down the first base, you know, foul line, and we got his autograph, and I got my son's picture with Altuve. The day before we went to go do this, he said, "Dad, I want to go out on the field with Jose Altuve." So I don't know if you get to pick. He's like, "Well, I'm going to go out there with him. I just know I am." And he goes, "And I want to get that picture developed." I said, "What picture?" He goes, "The picture I took with him." I said, "Why?" He goes, "Because I want to autograph it and give it to him." And so they gave it. He gave it to the girl. I think her name is, it's like Brianna or something.
Brianna Hughes. Yes.
Yeah. I think it was when she had kind of first started with them a few years ago, and he gave it to her, and she's like, "I'll put it in his locker." And wouldn't you know that he was the one that my son ran out on the field with. And my son just to this day still talks about how he's like, "You know, I beat Jose Altuve to second base, but I think he let me win," you know. And it's just things like that I've always felt like our teams really had the corner on the market on the players and the community outreach and how much they care about people and just how down to earth they appear to be. You know what I'm saying?
And I can't tell you that I've seen anything in the clubhouse to contradict that at all. It's not an act. Believe me, you know, when I was traveling with these guys, you get to see them on the airplane, hotel, things of that nature. And this is a very good group of guys.
Yeah, it is. I agree. I just want to kind of wrap things up with you. Just first of all, thank you seriously for taking time out of your day to just talk about what you've been through, your experiences, your time with the Astros, and just with that, couple that with just saying that it has been a great honor to finally touch base with you and, you know, be able to ask you these questions. It's kind of cool. I told my dad, I said, "Hey, you wouldn't believe who I'm interviewing tonight." So I was like, I can't come on here and like fanboy this thing. I've got to be professional. But I do appreciate your time. So to kind of wrap things up, what do you see going forward? You know, this next year, the Astros are really the odds-on favorite in Vegas to basically either go back or win the World Series. Do you see them getting a frontline starting pitcher in this offseason?
I think they'll get somebody who's an important pitcher and frontline. Well, I would say the frontliners are Verlander and Greinke. So mm-hmm. if they can get a number three type, you know, whether that's a Madison Bumgarner, and he probably is a little bit old for their purposes right now, but somebody of that degree who's done well and yet may not be, you know, a $30 million a year guy. He's got to fit into the budget somewhere there, but the payroll's going up. So, yeah, I think they will get somebody who will fit into that number three spot in the rotation. I think they need to get a starting catcher, whether it's re-signing Chirinos or not. But they need another catcher. Yes. And then the bullpen. The bullpen has to be a big mission now. What are you doing with Will Harris? Is he coming back? Joe Smith, there are several free agents in that bullpen who need to be replaced. So that's going to be an important part of it this winter.
Yeah, no, yeah, I agree. I think there's a lot of pieces. I think the encouraging thing is, and my hope is that Lance McCullers comes back stronger than ever. And, you know, I think if Lance McCullers can have a full season and he can stay away from, you know, injury, I think they're probably going to treat him with kid's gloves at first just because he's coming off Tommy John. But I think McCullers, just because his moxie and what he brings to the mound, his just confidence, I think he's going to be a big boost to this pitching staff when he gets back on the field.
Well, I have to agree with you, Brett, and I think if they can combine him with Jose Urquidy, you know, mm-hmm. McCullers, they may cut him off at 120 innings or so this year, but if they could combine him with an Urquidy or one of the other emerging guys from the minor leagues, that might fit very well in that rotation.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Well, man, I think things are still looking up. I think the Astros still have – I think they still have a lot of fight left in them. I know this losing the way they did was just – that's just – to me, it's got to leave a bad taste in your mouth. And I can't think that guys like Bregman and Altuve are satisfied, but even, I think, more hungry going into this next year to, you know, to get back and, you know, prove some things.
I would have to agree with you. And before we depart here, Brett,
yes.
How about a little Harry Carey? You want a little Harry Carey?
Yes. Yeah, do it. Let's go.
Brett, I can't believe that he dropped that pop-up. Mexicans never drop pop-ups in the sun. They play in the sun every day.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Oh, man, I love Harry. I would always do the Will Ferrell version.
Oh, yeah. He's a lot better than I am. I had to give it a shot. It wasn't very good, but.
You did great. No, awesome. Good job. I love it. That's an awesome way to end the show.
So, thank you, Brett.
Well, hey, thanks. We'll be in touch. Maybe when we get to spring training or something, maybe we can talk again to see once this 40-man roster is filled out, maybe we can talk about predictions for the season or something like that.
All the best to you. And man, I bless you for teaching. That is just great that you're a teacher. And all the best to you, Brett.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Brown or Brownie. I appreciate it. And, you know, just blessings to you and your family and all the continued hard work you're doing with the Education Foundation. And I just look forward to seeing you in more ceremonies, handing out awards to Astros and maybe recognizing Rookie of the Year. So maybe the Astros will have you come back and do that. Cause I do love when you're a part of their ceremonies, bringing people back and stuff. I think you do a great job.
Thank you, Brett. Have a good evening.
Hey, you too, Bill. Bye.